Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Day Player back with you here on 720 WGN. Keyboardist, singer, and songwriter Robert Lamb is a founding member of Rock and Roll Hall of Fame band Chicago. He wrote many of the band's biggest hits, including Question 67 and 68, Does Anybody Really Know What Time It Is, Beginnings 25 or 6 to 4, and Saturday in the Park. They've released 5 number one albums and nearly 36 top 10 hits. In October, the band was presented with the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award, and their album Chicago 2 turned 50 this year. And to talk about it all is Chicago founding member Robert Lamb. Robert, welcome in.
Thank you so much.
Well, Chicago has been around as long as I've been on the planet Earth, and I was born in 67, but I became a fan about a decade into your history and really rediscovering this amazing sound. Now, as a kid growing up in Brooklyn, you grew up with jazz playing in your home, you sang and played piano in the Brooklyn Heights Choir, you were 15 when you moved to Chicago, attended Chicago Vocational High School and Roosevelt University. What stayed with you all these years that influenced you about the city of Chicago?
My earliest memory is listening to the radio. Listening to the radio while I was going to high school, you know, getting up in the morning and, you know, getting ready to slog down the block over the icy sidewalks to wait for the bus to take me to school. But it's the radio stations in Chicago that struck me as very different than what I listened to in New York. And, of course, I was listening more to music as a teenager. But the variety of music that was and probably still is played on the radio stations in Chicago is varied. It's ethnically different. But there was a lot of jazz. There was a lot of R&B. And, of course, you know, the great top 40 stations at the time.
The WLSs, the WCLRs,
FYRs. Yeah, and all of those had a big effect on not only me, but the rest of my co-founders of the band. It was just a very rich place to draw from. Of course, then when the Beatles came to be, that changed everything for anybody who was a musician at the time.
Well, you played and wrote music very early on, and people always ask an artist, who's your inspiration? It was Ray Charles for you.
It was Ray Charles for me. And again, you know, the once the Beatles hit, the idea that a few guys in a little rock band could write their own songs and play them, that was a big awakening.
Now, at 23, you received a call to pursue your interest in forming a band. How did you come together with Walter, Terry, Danny, Lee, and James to form this rock and soul band that was first called The Big Thing?
I was playing with a couple of smaller bands around the North Side, mostly quartets, guitar, piano, drums, bass. And I just out of the blue, I received a telephone call one day, and I can't remember if it was Walt or Danny Serafin. It was one or the other, but it was explained to me the idea of putting together a rock band with horns, and was I interested? And they had heard that I played keyboards. And actually, I later heard that they had come to listen to the bands I was playing with at the time, and so I was invited to come and meet them, and was I interested? And I was interested because, you know, it was just I was accustomed to listening to jazz, as you mentioned earlier, from my parents' record collection, and so the idea was fascinating to me.
So when they said horns, it was so unique and different to say horns with a rock and roll band, that right there must have been pretty appealing.
It was, and of course, you know, in R&B, you know, whether it was Wilson Pickett or Sam and Dave or whoever in that day, in R&B, the horns were present in many of the records, and then a couple of the Beatles songs, Got to Get You Into My Life, particularly. There were horns present, so the Beatles were beginning to use horns, and so I thought this could be very interesting.
Now, you started touring around pretty quickly, and you were playing at clubs like Barnaby's in Chicago, where you also met the lead singer of a band called The Exceptions, and that was Peter, I believe.
Peter, The Exceptions were the premier rock band, club band, in those days. Everybody who was a musician or in a band was very aware of them and just awed by the skills that band had in reproducing top 40 hits live on stage.
And you took on Peter. You guys moved kind of to LA to kind of, you know, get your name a little bit out there and see some of these other record labels. You were making about $20 a week back then, right?
Well, courtesy of our producer Jimmy Garcia, who was also a Chicago native.
Yeah, and he was with CBS. Yeah.
Yeah. By then, he was a staff producer at CBS and had some success and had some leverage, and. At one of our Midwest dates, Walt Parizader contacted him by the phone and invited him to come and see us and listen to us, and maybe he'd be interested in taking us under his wing. He came, he listened, and he did.
Well, and the big thing, you know, the name of the band, I mean, you were a pretty big group with all the horns and instruments and all the players and so forth, but at some point somebody said, you know, we're going to change the name. Who came up with Chicago Transit Authority?
That was Jimmy Garcia. And later on, of course, while we were recording in New York, working on the first album, a staff member at CBS at Columbia Records came in and listened to some playbacks after the album was pretty well almost finished, and suggested that we shorten the name to Chicago, and that seemed like a logical progression.
Well, and you mentioned starting recording your first album in 69, not really having any experience. You guys were doing clubs and stuff, but not really ever being in a recording studio to put that together. That must have been, you know, I have to imagine it was exciting, but I would say nerve-wracking probably as well.
Well, you know, we were just kids, and, yeah. You know, we were of the age where many things were new. And we were experiencing virtually everything for the first time. And so walking into a major record label's recording studio, one of several that they had in New York City at the time, was just fascinating. And one of the studios in particular, Studio B on 52nd Street, mm-hmm. was just a huge recording studio and had instruments of all kinds just sort of sitting around or covered up waiting to be used, including one of the greatest sounding Steinway acoustic grand pianos.
Oh, how cool.
I had ever heard. Yeah. One that we've all heard on many historic recordings, including Chicago's.
Very, very cool. And, you know, I know, you know, you talk about being, you guys were so young. You were writing nonstop. This was a double album, you know, right out of the box. FM radio was just making a splash at the time where Chicago's music was really embraced. But some stations at that time, did they know how to identify what your group was all about because it was such a new and unique sound?
No, I think that then and even now, I think several reasons, I think that Chicago has failed to fall easily into any particular pigeonhole, partly because we were trying to do something different, partly because the songs were coming from several members in the band with differing influences. So it was really sort of hard to categorize Chicago. And then, of course, recording the first several albums, all of them double albums, we sort of didn't know any better that you weren't supposed to do that. But we did have a champion in Jim Guercio who was able to twist a few arms at Columbia Records. And luckily, Clive Davis, who was the head of Columbia Records, was willing to go along based upon success of the first album and the fact that we were really an accomplished performing band right from the get-go.
Well, landed you in Billboard's top 20, so the proof was in the pudding right there. 148 weeks consecutively on the charts. I'd say that's pretty good right out of the box.
I wish we could do it again.
And I bet you can. Well, I'll tell you what, we're talking to Robert Lamb of Chicago, and we'll have more with him next on 720 WGN. So, Robert, how did you approach the songwriting? Do you sit down at a certain time of day and write? You know, some people have a method to their madness. Do you wait for inspiration to put pen to paper? How does that all come about? Because, I mean, you write nonstop.
I have always tended to work sort of sporadically. And, of course, once Chicago started touring, I mean, even before the first album, once Chicago started touring, I was not very good at composing on the road, although I was smart enough to write down ideas, whether they be lyrical or just a melody idea. I was smart enough to make some notes so that when I did get home and I did get to a piano, I had something to start with. But my method has been very slow. I'm not like an Elton John who can just sort of dash off a number of songs in a matter of days. I work slowly, and I rewrite and rewrite and edit and change things as I go, and that has always been the case. Of course, writing for Chicago was a very different matter. It wasn't just writing a song. It was a matter of writing a composition that would include places where the horns could play and the various soloists in the band could play.
But but months after the release of the first album, you went on to work on the second album. That's why I say it was nonstop. I mean, it was every 9 months. I mean, you were writing and writing and while you were on tour doing all of this at the same time. I mean, that's a lot of content to be thrown out there.
I think that when you're young like that and, you're wanting to seek approval, you're young and hungry and lots of energy, I think that's appropriate. I mean, I'm glad that's the way it happened.
Yeah. And just as iconic as of the sound of Chicago, Robert, the logo is so iconic, always dominant on all the covers. Who said, you know what, because not a lot of bands, especially back then, had like a specific logo that was tied into their brand. You kind of made a brand for yourself with that logo. How did that all come together?
Oh, that was really a sort of a philosophical decision that was very much influenced by Jim Guercio. And we talked a lot about a creative community. We talked a lot about this is the age of the hippie and communes were happening where people would sort of step away from the mainstream of society and kind of work together and and you know, have the focus be on whatever the project was. And in our case, it's music. And Guercio's point was that it seemed, at least in rock and roll, that whenever the focus went away from the music and was put upon particular individuals or anything other than music, it was a distraction. And he was right. To this day, in spite of all the fame and all the places that we've played and all the music that people are familiar with, you know, I can still pretty much travel anonymously, and it's really been a great freedom for all of us.
Yeah, I bet. But at the time, you know, you were talking about, you know, what was going on at the time in some of the content. Your political consciousness went back to the late 60s, you know, the uprising in Chicago during the Democratic National Convention, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movements that were happening. You guys had a platform, and you used it.
We did use it, and partly because it was such a cultural change from anything that we had known as younger guys. So once the 60s hit, and the war in Vietnam was basically televised, as were you know, voter registrations in the South, and equal rights, not only for other races, but for women, that was beginning to emerge. I think all of that stuff we sensed, and it was in our faces in the news media, that it was something that was worth talking about, it was worth writing about, even though politically and socially, at least as far as the things that I wrote, I wasn't particularly conversant with all the issues, but I sensed that we needed to address some of it. So
yeah, you were talking about what was happening at the time. I mean, it was indicative of the that time in history. Third album was another double album, and then came Chicago at Carnegie Hall, went gold out of the box, and has since been certified for sales of like 2 million copies. This one was a little difficult to release. Was Columbia not willing to flip the bill for production? What was the deal with that? Because that was a great album.
I'm sure they weren't crazy about the idea, but yeah. I think that based upon the success of the previous albums and the fact that the Carnegie Hall album really did sort of document a historic thing as far as a rock band is concerned, playing at such a prestigious venue in New York, Carnegie Hall, for a solid week, selling it out, courting, and also able to sort of include in the box of records that resulted, you know, posters and information and lyrics and all that sort of thing. It was really kind of a, you know, it sort of created the idea of a box set.
Yeah, it was a collection. Yeah, it was fabulous. I mean, it was a great collector's copy.
Yeah.
Chicago 5, best remembered for Saturday in the Park, inspired by you seeing all these talented musicians throughout Central Park in New York. So even the albums had some inspiration behind them.
Well, the music doesn't come magically from nowhere, at least for me. I read a lot. I look at art a lot. I love films. I like watching cinema, and you know, all of that filters into. If not the music, although that definitely occurs because I listen to a lot of music all the time, but all of that is the grist, if you will, of where the music comes from.
Fast forward to the 80s, you moved down to Warner Brothers. David Foster took a hand in helping making the Chicago 16, co-writing 8 of the album's 10 songs, including Hard to Say I'm Sorry, which became a worldwide number one single when the album was released. The album went to the top 10, sold 1 million copies. The next was Chicago 17 in 84 with Stay the Night, Hard Habit to Break, You're the Inspiration, Along Comes a Woman. A whole new generation of fans at that time, just, you know, over a decade later, discovered what Chicago was all about.
I think that's true, and as a result of our continuing to tour around the world and playing, having the luxury of a large repertoire, as we played and performed, I think that audience that perhaps first discovered Chicago with Chicago 16 and 17 went back and looked through
that's
the catalog.
They did.
They went back and looked at their older siblings' vinyl collection.
I got to tell you, that's what I did. Because, I mean, I was born in 67, so I had to go back and do that. But I loved it. It was like a, wow, this is a pretty damn cool group, man. I mean, they've got a lot of history.
We still get comments like that all the time.
Chicago's very own Robert Lamb. The band's latest holiday album, Chicago Christmas, debuted last year and still available on iTunes and at Amazon.com. For more on Chicago, visit ChicagoTheBand.com. All right, top stories are next on 720 WGN.